Ladies and gentlemen, please can I introduce to you Robin Lustig.
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed. Good morning, everyone. It's really a great pleasure to be here. If you are a Radio 4 listener, you might find that you'll enjoy the talk more if you shut your eyes. Pretend you're listening to the radio. You can drift off to sleep, as I'm confident you often did while you were listening to The World Tonight. The greatest compliment I was ever paid was from people who used to say, "Oh, I always fall asleep listening to you." My talk is called Journalists and Novelists, Facts and Truth, which isn't actually a great title, but it was my idea, so I can't blame anybody else for it. And I want to start with a story. Two retired journalists are meeting up for a drink. "So," says the first journalist, "what are you up to these days?" "Oh, I'm writing a novel," says the second journalist. "That's amazing," replies the first journalist. "Neither am I." The point is this: there are very few journalists who haven't fantasized at some point about writing a novel. It's not surprising, after all. We write for a living, we construct narratives, we are, like novelists, storytellers. Yet very few journalists actually manage to write a novel, and only a tiny number manage to write a good novel. So I thought it might be interesting to look at why that might be. Are journalism and novel writing similar, or are they two entirely different things, the only real similarity being that they both involve putting words one in front of another? A few years ago, I interviewed the wonderful Nigerian novelist Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. She had just given a lecture in which she discussed what she called realist fiction. And let me quote a couple of lines. She said, "Realist fiction is not merely the recording of the real, as it were. It's more than that. It seeks to infuse the real with meaning, which perhaps is why the artist works with a frown. As events unfold, we do not always know what they mean. But in telling the story of what happened, meaning emerges, and we're able to make connections with emotive significance. Realist fiction is, above all, the process of turning fact into truth." Turning fact into truth. I found that a fascinating concept. So when I sat down with her in a BBC studio the following day, I asked her this question. "If you and I were to witness the same event, and then each of us were to write about it, you as a novelist and I as a journalist, how would our accounts differ?" She looked across the studio desk and she smiled. "People would be moved by what I wrote," she said. "They would be informed by what you wrote." Ali Smith made a slightly different point in a recent interview with Nicola Sturgeon at the Edinburgh Book Festival. They were discussing the prevalence of lies in modern society, something I'm going to be returning to a bit later on. But this is what Ali Smith said. "Fiction and lies are the opposite of each other. Lies go out of the way to distort and turn you away from the truth. But fiction is one of our ways of telling the truth." I heard Julian Barnes speaking at a public event in London just a couple of weeks ago. He came up with a splendid suggestion. All novels, he said, should have a sticker on the front cover. Trigger warning: contains truth. So Adichie and Smith and Barnes, all in agreement, fiction is a way of telling the truth. I would argue, as a journalist, that journalism is as well. But let's use Adichie's formula as a starting point. People are moved by what novelists write. They are merely informed by what journalists write. Of course, as a journalist, I do want people to be informed by my journalism. I marshal the facts to the best of my ability. I sort them into some kind of structure and hope that in doing so, I am imparting useful and accurate information. Rule number one for all journalists: get it right. But do I also sometimes want people who read what I've written or who hear what I have broadcast to be moved? Do I want my work to have, to use Adichie's phrase, emotive significance? And if I do, am I then straying across that line which she says divides novelists from journalists? Listen to this passage and then see if you can decide whether it was written by a journalist or a novelist. The road south is narrow and endless. We've been driving since early morning, and the green hill country has begun to lose focus. It's a blur onto which has been painted occasional villages in shades of muddy brown and the burned yellow of banana thatch. At each village, small boys run to the edge of the road, offering cokes and bananas for sale. Some of them thrust skewers of burned meat, rancid and charcoal black, through the window. At first, we found them entertaining, almost dancing in front of us, cheering excitedly as we approached. Now, 7 hours later, they are tiresome. Another hazard of the road, along with the cattle and the goats. Any journey, even towards war, becomes a matter of routine if it goes on long enough. Or how about this passage? For several mornings, they were pursued by yellow butterflies, which were a welcome change from the tsetses. The butterflies came tacking into the saloon as soon as it was light, while the river still lay under a layer of mist like steam on a vat. When the mist cleared, they could see one bank lined with white nenuphars, which from 100 yards away resembled a regiment of swans. The colour of the water in this wider reach was pewter, except where the wheel churned the wake to chocolate, and the green reflection of the woods was not mirrored on the surface, but seemed to shine up from underneath the paper-thin, transparent pewter. Now, both those passages are powerful descriptions of an African journey. Both, I think, conjure up vivid images in our minds. Some of you may have recognised the second passage. The word nenuphars perhaps was a giveaway. They're water lilies, by the way. It comes from A Burnt Out Case, of course, by Graham Greene. But the first passage was written by a former colleague of mine at the BBC, Fergal Keane, in his book Season of Blood, A Rwandan Journey, in which he recounts his experiences reporting the Rwandan genocide more than 20 years ago. Now, Fergal is a journalist. His book is clearly not a novel. But does it have emotive significance? Does it do more than inform? Does it move? I think the answers are yes in each case. In which case, the line which Adichie tried to draw may not be as clear as she suggested. Here's another example for you to consider. As the sun's last rays bathed the cathedral square in light, the symbols of communism and Catholicism overlapped and seemed almost to merge. The heavy walnut coffin was carried solemnly from the cathedral, and hundreds of red flags dipped in respect. Fists were raised in a communist salute that seemed to be directed at the small crucifix carried by a priest in front of the coffin. Now that is a description of the funeral of a young Italian communist activist who was shot dead by neo-fascists in 1976. It is in fact journalism, it was written by a journalist, and it does, I think, convey the facts of the funeral. I think, though, it also does more. I should admit, by the way, that I'm the journalist who wrote it. While I was a correspondent for Reuters news agency based in Rome. Now, I could have written it differently, of course. I could have written, a young communist activist was buried today after a Catholic funeral in his hometown of Sezze Romano. So why didn't I write it like that? It would have been much more in keeping with Reuters' usual style, spare, unadorned prose, conveying the facts simply and succinctly. More than 40 years later, I can no longer remember why I chose to write it as I did. Perhaps I fancied myself as a new Ernest Hemingway, but I think I probably did want my report to have some kind of emotive significance by highlighting that juxtaposition of communism and Catholicism in a single ceremony. Perhaps I even came close to crossing that line, turning facts into truth. Perhaps I felt that the facts on their own, baldly stated, weren't quite enough. One thing I am sure of, however, I was not then, am not now and never will be a novelist. Zadie Smith wrote in her introduction to The Quiet American, "Too much time has been spent defending Green against the taint of journalism. We should think of him instead as the greatest journalist there ever was. If more journalists could report as well as Green, bringing us the explosion in the square, how long could we retain the stomach to fight the wars we do?" Now, I might take issue with her use of the word taint in such close proximity to the word journalism, but I do think I see what she's getting at. She, like me, I think, sees that line between facts and truth as far more blurred, more indistinct than we might think at first. Green certainly understood journalism and journalists. Like Evelyn Waugh in Scoop, which to me is still the finest novel about journalism ever written, he understood the absurdity that so often accompanies the practice of journalism. Here's Fowler, the cynical, world-weary journalist in The Quiet American. "I fly to Hanoi Airport. They give us a car to the press camp. They lay on a flight over the two towns they've recaptured, and they show us the tricolour flying. It might be any darned flag at that height. Then we have a press conference, and a colonel explains to us what we've been looking at. Then we file our cables with the censor. Then we have drinks. Best barman in Indochina. Then we catch the plane back." Now, I've never reported from Vietnam, but I do recognise that picture only too clearly. There's another Fowler line that has stayed with me. "My fellow journalists called themselves correspondents. I preferred the title of reporter. I wrote what I saw. I took no action. Even an opinion is a kind of action." There's a character in the Tom Stoppard play Night and Day who puts it well. "A foreign correspondent is someone who lives in foreign parts and corresponds, usually in the form of essays containing no new facts. Otherwise, he's someone who flies around from hotel to hotel and thinks that the most interesting thing about any story is the fact that he has arrived to cover it." But back to Fowler and The Quiet American. Even an opinion is a kind of action. Are reporters really not allowed to have opinions? Not when they work for the BBC, that's for sure. Although here again, the lines can get blurred. There are strict guidelines to be followed at the BBC. And if you will forgive me, I'm going to quote now from my memoir, Is Anything Happening? And I see there's a large pile of them over there, just by coincidence. In the book, I cite the relevant section of the BBC guidelines. The BBC's editorial guidelines for news presenters, a set of rules that should really have been inscribed in stone for Moses to bring down from Mount Sinai, are meant to help presenters negotiate a path between the safe ground of news and the treacherous shoals of comment. They are not, alas, quite as clear as "thou shalt not kill." Quote from the editorial guidelines: "Our audiences should not be able to tell from BBC output the personal prejudices of our journalists or news and current affairs presenters on matters of public policy, political or industrial controversy, or on controversial subjects in any other area. They may provide professional judgments rooted in evidence, but may not express personal views." I then add in my book, "The fine distinction that separates professional judgments from personal views is the kind of thing that could keep you awake at night if you were the worrying kind." Martin Bell, who some of you may remember, who reported for the BBC with great distinction from Bosnia and from many other places, used to talk of what he called the journalism of attachment as opposed to bystander journalism. Good journalism, he argued, especially journalism about conflict and war, cannot, should not, confine itself to clinical, factual narrative. It must, had said Bell, show that the journalist cares as well as that he knows. A journalist's words, he might have argued, must carry emotive significance. Now, I agree that facts alone are sometimes not enough. My aim as a reporter is always to try to convey to a reader or a listener what they might see or hear or feel if they were where I am. But I don't think I need to tell them what I think or what I feel. My aim is to provide enough information for them to form their own emotional response. Here, I say to them, take hold of my hand. I want to show you something. This is how my friend Marie Colvin of the Sunday Times, who was killed in Syria in 2012, explained why she and other war correspondents put their lives on the line. Someone has to go there and see what is happening. You can't get that information without going to places where people are being shot at and others are shooting at you. The real difficulty is having enough faith in humanity to believe that enough people, be they government, military, or the man in the street, will care when your file reaches the printed page, the website, or the TV screen. We do have that faith because we believe we do make a difference. She might have said, because we believe that what we write has emotive significance. Like all journalists, Marie believed that information is power, and that if people are well informed, they then have the power to make a difference, even to make things better. Why report wars, after all, if not to bring home to people the reality of war, in the hope that the knowledge will make future wars less likely? If I may digress just for a moment, an extraordinary documentary film has just been released called Under the Wire, which charts Marie's last reporting trip to Syria and her death through the eyes of her photographer colleague Paul Conroy, who was severely wounded in the artillery attack that killed her. And I do highly recommend that film if you get a chance to see it. But the reason I mention it here is that in a review that was published in the New York Review of Books, the Glasgow-based academic Mohammed Idris Ahmad challenged that belief that knowledge is power. In the case of Syria, he wrote, journalism proved inadequate to the task. Knowledge, it emerged, is not power, and power, when left unchallenged, can bend knowledge to its will. The death of Marie Colvin, who, by the way, there is strong evidence to believe was directly and deliberately targeted by the Syrian army, and the gruesome murders of other foreigners by the Islamic State group in Syria, made it all but impossible for foreign journalists to continue to cover that war. And what we have learned in Syria, as in many other places, is that if journalists can't tell the truth about what people in power are doing, then those people will construct their own version of the truth. 4 years ago, I reported from the world's newest nation, South Sudan, which was already disintegrating into civil war. I saw people on the brink of starvation, utterly destitute, and in very real fear of their lives. I was very angry and very upset at what I saw. But I tried to control my emotions when I filed a long piece for The Observer. This is how it began. It is happening again. 20 years after the genocide in Rwanda, 30 years after the famine in Ethiopia, Africa's twin scourges are back. This time it is a single country facing a double disaster. South Sudan, the world's newest nation, not yet 3 years old, is on the brink of catastrophe. Short sentences, no emotive adjectives, just stark facts, which I hope said what needed to be said. Facts, yes, but also, I hope, at least a nugget of truth. So let's try to imagine a novel about South Sudan, written perhaps by Graham Greene himself. The first thing to say is that he would certainly have spent more than 5 days there. He would also have spent more than 2 hours sitting at his typewriter. I often think that people fail to appreciate how journalists actually operate at great speed and under great pressure. Facts are hard enough to gather in the little time available. Truth will often have to wait until later. More importantly, though, Greene would have created a central character to drive his narrative. A character like Fowler in The Quiet American, or Query in A Burnt Out Case, or Castle in The Human Factor, the character would be complex, conflicted, a human peg on which to hang profound questions about both the human condition and the condition of the world in which we live. And that device, the central character, closely drawn with a rich backstory, has now become an essential tool in nearly all journalists' box of tricks. It's time for another example. This one comes from Esquire magazine in 1962, a piece headlined Joe Lewis, the King as a Middle-Aged Man by Gay Talese. Here's how it starts. Hi, sweetheart, Joe Lewis called to his wife, spotting her waiting for him at Los Angeles Airport. She smiled, walked toward him, and was about to stretch up on her toes to kiss him, but suddenly stopped. Joe, she said, where's your tie? Ah, sweetie, he said, shrugging. I stayed out all night in New York and didn't have time. All night, she cut in. When you're out here, all you do is sleep, sleep, sleep. Sweetie, Joe Lewis said with a tired grin, I'm an old man. It's a prose style that became known as the new journalism, of which Tom Wolfe was perhaps the best known practitioner. In the 1960s and 70s, it was considered revolutionary, adopting the style of the novel and of the short story, marshalling facts like a journalist's and turning them into truth like a novelist. In 1984, I reported from India after the army there had ruthlessly brought to an end a Sikh insurgency in Punjab, centred on the Golden Temple in Amritsar. I was working for The Observer at the time. Here's how one of my reports began. Major General Shubeg Singh, Indian Army cashiered, died with his walkie-talkie still in his hands. The man who for the past 2 years had been the military mastermind behind Punjab's bloody rebellion by Sikh fundamentalists was calling the shots right to the end. He died of bullet wounds in the smoke-filled basement of one of the holiest buildings in the Golden Temple of Amritsar. A central character, a device used as a hook to draw in the reader. It's now so commonplace that it's become a cliche. I promise you, pick up any newspaper this weekend, turn to the feature pages, and likely as not, you will find there a story that opens with a similar device. In 1996, more than 1,200 men were massacred in Libya's notorious Abu Salim jail. It went virtually unreported until after the overthrow of the Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. Lindsay Hilsum, international editor of Channel 4 News, wrote a book about the Libyan revolution called Sandstorm, in which she described meeting the families of some of the men who had been slaughtered. Here's an extract. A woman thrust a small blue envelope into my hand, the kind used by old-fashioned photographic shops. I opened it in my hotel room and found a faded colour passport picture of a round-faced boy with thick black hair, wearing a cream shirt, and a similar-sized photograph of an older man with white hair, wearing a black fez and a traditional black robe, a jird, fringed with gold brocade. A closer look reveals that he is sitting in a wheelchair. His legs, which are covered in white bandages, have been amputated at the knee. A father, a husband, an uncle. How did he lose his legs? Was he already disabled when they threw him into prison? I keep the pictures in my study. The boy and the old man stare out at me. People I never knew, victims of a crime I never heard about until long years after their killers tossed their bodies into an anonymous mass grave. Facts or truth? It's journalism, without a doubt. But when you read it, are you informed? Or are you also moved? I remember once talking to a reporter who'd been embedded with American troops during the invasion of Iraq in 2003. Being embedded means that you are assigned to a particular military unit and you go only where they go and you see only what they see. The only real difference between the soldier and the reporter is that the soldier has a weapon and the reporter does not. And this particular reporter said something to me that struck me as quite profound. He said, being embedded is like watching a war through a letterbox. You can see what's directly in front of your eyes, but that's it. You have no idea how it fits into the broader picture. Now, that applies to more than just embedded reporters hurtling across a battlefield in an armoured vehicle. A reporter can be in only one place at a time, has only two eyes, and can talk to only a limited number of people before the next deadline. Novelists, on the other hand, well, novelists can take as long as they like. I'm tempted to say to Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, I'll deal with the facts now as best I can. You look after the truth at your leisure. To be fair, she did recognise this journalistic dilemma in her lecture. Remember that line from the extract I quoted earlier, as events unfold, we do not always know what they mean. I'd phrase it slightly differently. As events unfold, we never know what they mean. As a BBC News presenter for more than 20 years, I asked many hundreds of stupid questions. But by far the most common, was some variant of, so what do you think it all means? The only honest answer, of course, is, I have no idea. We'll have to wait. But woe betide any interviewee who might be so honest. That is not what editors, or indeed what listeners or viewers, want to hear. We live in an age of instant gratification. We want to know everything, and we want to know it now. Waiting is not an option. Now, as you'll have gathered by now, I don't regard journalists and novelists as somehow occupying entirely different planets in the literary universe. Journalists with their pathetically inadequate facts, and novelists with their profound and enduring truths. Look at Charles Dickens, journalist and novelist. Look at Graham Greene, even if he was tainted, to use Zadie Smith's word, in the eyes of his critics, he was both journalist and novelist. He did deal in both facts and truth. The main problem I have with Adichie's formula, and I should make it clear that I adore her writing and was utterly awestruck when I met her, is that both facts and truth, how can I put this, are somewhat slippery concepts. What exactly is a fact? What indeed is truth? I looked both words up in the dictionary. The dictionary definition of the word fact is that it is a thing that is known or proved to be true. And the definition of true, in accordance with fact or reality. So the definitions form a perfect circle. It is a fact if it is true, and it is true if it is a fact. Which brings us to George Orwell. In 1984, as I'm sure you will remember, the central principle of the ruling party is that the past is mutable. It has no objective existence. It survives only in written records and in human memories. But since the party controls all the records and is in full control of the minds of its members, it follows that the past is whatever the party chooses to make it. Consider the tale of that notorious meeting that Donald Trump's son, Donald Jr., had with a Russian emissary during the presidential election campaign in 2016. At first, the Trump campaign denied there had been any meetings with Russians. Then they admitted that this meeting had taken place, but they said that it was primarily to discuss a program for the adoption of Russian children. And then, just last month, the president himself said, on Twitter, naturally, that the meeting was, quote, to get information on an opponent. In the words of Trump's lawyer speaking in a television interview, over time, facts develop. Facts develop. It is pure Orwell. Sometimes it's a fact that 2 and 2 are 4 and that the sun rises in the east, but over time, these facts develop. Sometimes 2 and 2 equal 5, or perhaps 6. And the sun doesn't rise in the east, but in the west, or even in the south. In his book, The Art of the Deal, published more than 20 years ago, Donald Trump wrote in praise of what he called truthful hyperbole, which he called an innocent form of exaggeration. Innocent, he said, because people want to believe that something is the biggest and the greatest and the most spectacular. Orwell would have understood Trump perfectly. The truth is what people want to believe, and they're happy to believe what they are told by a leader whom they trust. Just as Orwell predicted, the party controls the past, so the party controls the truth. Now, I hope you understand why I dwell on this. As a reporter for nearly 50 years, I have spent my entire adult life believing that facts are important and that the truth does matter. I have never believed that over time facts develop, or that there is such a thing as truthful hyperbole. You will remember when Trump insisted that the crowds at his inauguration were the biggest ever, despite all the evidence to the contrary. And you will remember how his spokeswoman explained away the discrepancy. Trump's facts, she said, were alternative facts. Now, I am prepared to admit to an uncomfortable truth. There are facts, and there are facts. Two reporters can observe the same event, both of them can report it entirely accurately, and they can still come up with two very different accounts. How? Well, by choosing to marshal different facts, to emphasize some and to disregard others. The choices that journalists make are not rooted in science, but in their own understanding of what matters, what's important, and what isn't. Let me give you an example. 18 years ago, several white farmers were murdered in Zimbabwe by activists who called themselves war veterans and who said they were seizing white-owned farms in furtherance of President Mugabe's land reform policies. I was working at the BBC at the time, and of course, we reported the murders. On one occasion, in fact, during a reporting trip to Zimbabwe, I even managed to visit a white-owned farm as it was being besieged by heavily armed pro-government activists. Now, some of the white farmers who were attacked were also activists in the main Zimbabwean opposition party, the MDC. But what was more relevant to the BBC's listeners, that they were white or that they were opposition supporters? A white farmer and his family were murdered today in Zimbabwe by war veterans who said they were seizing their land to redistribute to landless peasants. That is a truthful statement of the facts. An opposition activist and his family were murdered today by pro-government militiamen who invaded their farm. That is also a truthful statement of the facts. But they are different facts, and they give a subtly different interpretation of what happened. Here's another one. Palestinian fighters fired a salvo of rockets into Israel last night after Israeli troops killed a teenager in Gaza. Alternatively, Israel responded in force to a cross-border incursion by Palestinian fighters last night, during which a number of shots were fired. One Palestinian was reported killed. Both reports are accurate, but each chooses to frame the narrative differently. Now, I know I've strayed somewhat from my central theme, but I do think it's important to acknowledge that neither facts nor truth are quite as unambiguous as we might sometimes like to think. Let me refer you back to my report from Italy on the funeral of that young communist all those years ago. As the sun's last rays bathed the cathedral square in light, I wrote, the symbols of communism and Catholicism overlapped and seemed almost to merge. Seemed? What kind of fact is that? Did the symbols of communism and Catholicism merge, or didn't they? Fists were raised in a communist salute that seemed to be directed at the small crucifix carried by a priest in front of the coffin. Seemed again. In my striving for truth, was I perhaps guilty of stretching the facts? If I'd been writing a novel, of course, it wouldn't have mattered. Novelists are allowed to stretch facts in their search for truth. Journalists, on the other hand, quite rightly, are expected not to stray. When we read a novel, we know we're reading fiction. The events described did not really happen. The characters who people its pages did not really exist. Some of you may have read a wonderful novel called Capital by John Lanchester. It's a novel about London, centred on one fictional street, Pepys Road, in Clapham. And it captures the essence of the city in a way that I don't think journalism ever could. It conveys a truth about London in a way that facts alone could not, even though Lanchester is in fact a journalist as well as a novelist. The same can apply, by the way, in the world of film. Some of you may have seen the Ken Loach film, I, Daniel Blake, a couple of years ago. It's the fictional depiction of what can happen when a man slips through the benefits net and falls victim to heartless austerity. But everything in it, according to the filmmakers, was based on actual events. So when I interviewed the producer, Rebecca O'Brien, I asked her why, if everything in it was true, they hadn't made the film as a documentary. Because, she said, the story they told was more powerful and more truthful when created as a fictional narrative. I think Charles Dickens, for example, would have understood. Now, I decided when I was preparing this talk that I really should reread some Graham Greene. So I chose four of his novels. A Burnt Out Case, which had made an enormous impression on me when I first read it as a teenager. Our Man in Havana, which remains one of my all-time favourites. The Quiet American, and The Human Factor, which for my money does Le Carré rather better than Le Carré does. What they have in common, and what marks them out as novels, is that they are all character-driven. And they led me to conclude that perhaps the most significant difference between what journalists do and what novelists do is that whereas journalists try to describe the state of the world, novelists often focus on the state of the human condition. It's not so much a question of facts and truth, which, as I have suggested, get hopelessly blurred when you start prodding at them a bit, but with the collective and the individual. In other words, journalism tells us about the world we live in, novels tell us about who we are. And I think perhaps that might be the main reason why so few journalists make good novelists. We journalists are trained to look at what has happened, not at the people who have been caught up in what happened. Many journalists turned novelists, such as Frederick Forsyth, Gerald Seymour, Robert Harris, do tend to produce novels that are driven as much by narrative as by character. There are, of course, exceptions. The journalists whose work really will live on, Dickens, Mark Twain, Hemingway, Greene himself, are the ones who successfully crossed that line. So we have David Copperfield and Nicholas Nickleby, Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn, Maurice Castle in The Human Factor, Fowler and Pyle in The Quiet American. They're characters who come alive from the page, who embed themselves in our minds. There are very few journalists who can do that. It's not what we are trained to do. It would be dishonest of me to end without an admission of guilt. For much of my adult life, I read very few novels. I was, I am afraid, an obsessive journalist. I was addicted to facts, you might say, rather than to truth. Only as I approached the age of decrepitude did I finally acknowledge that I was missing something. And what I was missing was an understanding of the human condition. So now I am reading novels. Home Fire by Camilla Shamsi, The Gentleman in Moscow by Amor Towles, Honor by Elif Shafak. Perhaps I'm spending a bit less time keeping up with the latest Brexit developments. I hope I'm spending more time learning what it means to be human. Fewer facts, but perhaps more truth. Thank you very much.
I think that says it all, that amazing round of applause. Your sweeps of fiction, non-fiction, world events, history showed a polymathic understanding, everything that we experienced when we listened to you on The World Tonight. A former director who comes here sometimes, Professor Neil Sinyard, once quoted a particular novelist, I think it was Orwell, who said, a writer is someone on whom nothing is lost. And I think you caught everything there, and I hope you might consider writing a novel one day, who knows. Anyway, there must be lots of questions for Robin. Several hands have gone up. So can we start with the gentleman on the right, please? Thanks.
Well, I thought that was a really very amazing and impressive talk. I do appreciate that. Let me put this to you. There is the... Karl Popper had this notion of science as that which is capable of being disproven. Could that be said of journalism? And is that the distinction between journalism and novels and fiction?
Gosh. It's really tricky. I said that I don't believe that facts develop, but our understanding of truth develops. The more we know, the more we understand. That's the theory, at least. I sometimes fear that the opposite is the case. The more I read about Brexit, for example, the less I understand. There's an old saying, well, there used to be during the Troubles in Northern Ireland, that if you think you understand the Irish question, you obviously haven't been listening.
Right.
As a journalist, I have never pretended that I was able to get at the truth. You'll be aware, I think, of one of the definitions of journalism as the first rough draft of history. My emphasis has always been on first and rough. As I suggested in that talk, journalists work at great speed, they work under great pressure. They, if they're lucky, get a snapshot of what's going on. My daughter studied history at university, and I was hugely jealous of historians and the luxury they have of looking back over decades or sometimes centuries and putting things together so that they make some sort of sense. The vast majority of the journalism that I've done has made very little sense to me other than as a fleeting snapshot. I write a blog now. Indeed, I started it while I was still at the BBC. It's called Lustig's Letter, but the strapline underneath says, trying to make sense of the world. And a BBC Panjundrum said, can't we just call it Making Sense of the World? I said, no, the whole point is trying to make sense of the world. What I love, having recently rediscovered the joy of reading novels, is that novels do offer so much more than journalism does. I wouldn't ever have wanted to be anything other than a journalist, but nor would I pretend that we get to the truth.
Great, and Beatrice, I think you had a question.
First, thank you very much for a wonderful talk. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you about Green's practice of journalism, if you want. When he was doing it, when he was practicing journalism, that practice was based on that aphorism that said, facts are sacred, comment is free, right? But at the same time, with the depiction, with the description that he that's of Fowler in The Quiet American. Don't you think that he was trying to criticize, this practice of journalism, favoring somehow the practice of journalism as conceived by Kapuscinski, for example, or by Martin Bell, later on?
We'll leave Kapuscinski one side because, as you may know, there are now some serious questions about the accuracy of some of what he did. I have some problems with Martin Bell's concept of the journalism of attachment. One of the almost universal phenomena which you can observe when looking at how journalists report conflict is that inevitably they take the side of those who are on the receiving end of the conflict, and quite right too, because that's not the narrative that comes from governments or from military. But it does mean, for example, that if you were in Beirut in 1982 when it was under Israeli bombardment, or if you were in Sarajevo in Bosnia in the early 1990s when it was under bombardment by Serb artillery. Your reporting and your sympathy, and therefore the sympathy of your reader or your viewer or your listener, would almost inevitably be with those on the receiving end. Now, it may be that those on the receiving end were part of a community who were also doing the same thing to other people. I don't know if any of you have started watching a new TV series called Black Earth Rising, which is about the Rwanda genocide. And from the two episodes I've seen so far, rather cleverly depicts the moral ambiguity of how victims can also be perpetrators. And it is a truth which in war reporting is sometimes quite difficult to get across. If I were an editor, I would always try to make sure that I had reporters on both sides of a conflict so that you could see that what was happening to one group of people might also be happening to another group of people. Who is to blame? Who is guilty? Those are really tricky. I remember many years ago when there was some trouble in Kashmir, another one of those conflicts, a bit like the Irish one, where if you think you understand it, you haven't been listening. An editor said to me, all I want to know about Kashmir is who are the goodies and who are the baddies. And so I did an interview with a leading expert on Kashmir. And I said, okay, let's start from the fundamentals. The Indian position on Kashmir is as follows, A, B, C, D. The Pakistani position on Kashmir is as follows, X, Y, Z. Who's right? Well, he said, they both are. And that's the starting point. So yes, the journalism of attachment, I can understand the feeling behind it, and I can understand why somebody like Martin Bell, who was in Sarajevo during the bombardment and the siege, should feel as he did. And I have certainly felt the same when I've been in conflict situations. But it's not a whole truth. It is part of what journalism does. And you also need the analysts back in London writing their think pieces. Comment is free. The facts are sacred. But there are lots of different facts.
Yes, Jonathan.
That sentence that you mentioned, the truth is what people want to believe, you know, like reminding me of the attitude showed by Parkinson in a burnt out case and fake news. Because for me, I mean, it's the same, right?
Fake news. Who decides it's fake? How do we know it's fake? What's the definition of fake? One of the many sins of which Donald Trump is guilty is of inventing, or rather popularizing, a phrase which is capable of so much misunderstanding. One of the most worrying things I learnt about fake news was a fact, which I believe, that in the run-up to the presidential election in America in 2016, more fake news stories on Facebook were downloaded than real news stories. There's a story, I'm going to divert slightly, but it makes a point. One of those fake news stories was a report from Ohio that a warehouse full of ballot boxes stuffed with pre-marked ballot papers in favor of Hillary Clinton had been found. This story appeared online on the website of something, I'm speaking from memory now, but I think it was called www.christiannewspaper.com, and it was downloaded 6 million times. It was a fake story. It had been invented by a young student as a way of making money, because the more people who downloaded it, the more he would get from the people who were advertising on that site. ChristianNewspaper.com was a phony. There is no such site. He had invented it. He'd bought the domain name. And he realized that that story would make him money because he knew that's what Trump supporters wanted to hear. They wanted to hear that the election was being rigged, that the ballots were being stuffed, and he would give them what they wanted. There's a famous story in entertainment, which is that nobody ever lost money by underestimating their audience. And it is true that if you tell people what they want to hear, they are more ready to believe it than if you try to tell them what they don't want to hear. We are all guilty of that. If I ask each of you where you get your information from, you will identify a newspaper or a website or a TV broadcast that tells you that the world is as you would like the world to be. There are very few people who choose to read things that upset them or that they disagree with or which forces them to rethink their understanding of the world. And that's what's so clever about fake news. It tells people what they want to hear, different groups of people. And it's, in my view, very, very dangerous.
Okay, go ahead, please, Mark.
I just wanted to make one little comment, because this is a wonderful thing. I've been teaching students at Georgetown about the same kind of discussion, actually. But one of the things that one of my students came up, and I just bring it as something to add, is that you translated truth and fact. But the third definition is fiction, fixio, which means a facsimile of the truth or what's real. And so there is that artistic sensibility, that gap, where you said journalism is at the moment, right? There is this time for reflection and a sense of what is adequate to human experience that a fiction writer, the novelist, gets to do. So I just wanted to add that too, that might be the third definition if you were ever to publish this, because it was really quite wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I discovered as I was preparing for today was that once you start tugging on that piece of string, it just takes you further and further into all kinds of different places. But I mean, if we move into the realm of art, my favorite work of art is the Magritte, Ceci n'est pas un pipe. Because as soon as you try to translate something three-dimensional into something different, you are distorting by definition, or you're changing. Journalism pretends to change less because it just tells you what happened, but it doesn't. I mean, one of the reasons I called my book, Is Anything Happening? First of all, it's a question that a journalist asks every day when he wakes up, because if nothing's happening, he's out of a job. But also because it encapsulates, and I discuss it a little bit in the book, what a journalist thinks is interesting about what's happening is a subjective judgment. I have sat in countless editorial meetings where we have discussed what we're going to put in the newspaper or what we're going to broadcast in the radio program, and somebody will say, no, that's not interesting, or no, we'll not do that, we did that last week, or we won't do that, we'll do this instead. All those are subjective judgments. There are any number of things going on in the world, there are any number of things going on in Berkhamsted as we sit here. Very few of them will make it into the public prints or onto BBC Radio 4. Why not? They're interesting to somebody. When I was at The Observer for a time, I was the news editor. And I can remember every Saturday afternoon going into the editor's office with my list of stories which I thought should be considered for page one. And he would say, no, 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 no. And I would say, but that's a really important story. You know, yeah, it might be important. He said, but it's not interesting.
Okay, Jonathan, please, yeah.
Thank you very much for a wonderfully thought through contribution and analysis. It was illuminating and inspiring. I wanted to ask whether you have ever considered, or whether you might consider, in view of everything you've said, editing an anthology of great journalism.
Because editing a what, sorry?
An anthology of great journalism. Because if we can't persuade you to become a novelist, I'm sure there are quite a few of us in this room who would queue up to buy that book. It's an observation.
There are quite a few, actually, anthologies of journalism. I'm not sure whether they would claim to be great journalism. But, I mean, you encapsulate the issue, really. I mean, what I consider great journalism might not be what you consider great journalism. I quoted a little bit from that extraordinary Guy Talese piece from Esquire about Joe Lewis. And I got that from an anthology by Tom Wolfe of what was called The New Journalism. It was published, I guess, in the early 70s. And it reminded me of the extraordinary flowering of that form of journalism, which came largely actually out of the civil rights movement of the Vietnam War. We now take it for granted, very much character-led, very much personality-driven. You will have noticed, by the way, if you watch a lot of television documentaries, that nearly all foreign TV documentaries now have a celebrity presenter, have a Michael Palin or a Sue Perkins or somebody else whom you already know as the lead character. I'm at the moment trying to persuade a television production company to send me around the world to do a series of TV documentaries. And the question they came back with was, why you? The honest answer, of course, is because I want to do it. But that's not good enough. Character-led, driven, great journalism. What is great journalism? I've got a bookshelf full of journalist anthologies. And what's slightly depressing, although it will be less surprising to you than to me, is how little of it really lasts. A piece of journalism that you might read in your Sunday paper tomorrow will stay with you a day or two, if the journalist has really done a fabulous job, a week or two. If it was a stunning piece, 2-3 years? Very rarely more than that. Very rarely. Do you remember last year there was a drama series on television? It sounds like I spend my time watching TV, about Jeremy Thorpe. And at the end of the series, they showed a panorama documentary, which was never shown at the time because it was defamatory. Watching that documentary, which had been made 40 years ago, was an extraordinary reminder of how the language of TV journalism had changed. God, it was boring. It was one of television's best reporters, Tom Mangold, sitting behind a desk, opining to camera, and a few interviews, of course. But compare it to modern television techniques, partly because of the development of technology, which enables you to do so much more than you could 40 years ago, but also because the grammar of journalism has changed, the way we tell stories has changed, was really remarkable. So the short answer to your question is, I don't think so. Do it yourself.
Brilliant. We've got time for one more quick question, please. So Andrew, please.
I want to leave time for you all to buy the book. Yes.
So I'll be short and sweet. I can relate to the fact that in my professional life, I think I've read 2 novels since I graduated, hardly any time. One thing that strikes me as a civil engineer involved in tunneling, where we only talk of uncertainty, we have no idea what's going to happen. We try and evolve different scenarios, different possibilities. In what you highlighted today, there's a striving to have the unique interpretation. And in my profession, we never seek the unique interpretation. We just try and make sure the consequences are managed. So how do you see this the use of uncertainty in journalism, trying not seek the truth, but the ranges of truth?
One thing that being a journalist does teach you is how rare a commodity certainty is. That there's a famous phenomenon that all reporters are familiar with, which is making one phone call too many. You think you've got the story, you've understood what's happened, you've spoken to everybody you need to speak to, but you'll just make one more phone call and everything changes. That one phone call. It contradicts something that you thought you understood. It opens up a whole new door. Uncertainty is everywhere. Just using the parallel with engineering, I'm always fascinated by and hugely in awe of engineers because of what they do. And I was reading about the new giant sewer project under the River Thames, which is being built at the moment, which is a stunning engineering feat to build this giant tunnel underneath the River Thames way below where the London Tube goes and everything else. And what struck me about that, I mean, engineering, I always thought, was based on well-proven, well-tried mathematical and scientific principles. If you pour this kind of cement into this kind of hole, this will happen. What I learned was that although the theory obviously is right, in practice it sort of doesn't always turn out the way it was meant to turn out. So I'm not sure that there's certainty anywhere. I understand nothing about physics, but I'm always encouraged by the fact that even physicists admit that there are things they don't understand, or things which they thought they understood 20 years ago, they no longer understand. I mean, particularly if you go into astrophysics and try to understand what Stephen Hawking wrote about, which I never could, there are no certainties. So one of the joys of being a journalist is trying to find some certainty, or at least trying to reduce the amount of uncertainty, because if, like me, you are chronically curious, then it's nice occasionally to find an answer to a question. I quote in my book a letter that was written to my parents by an uncle of mine when I was born, and he lived in America, and he wrote to my parents, "What I wish for your son is that he grows up to be an asker of questions, because that way he might find some answers." I never knew about this letter until I'd been a journalist for several decades, but it was a wonderful sort of fairy godfather waving a wand over my crib. I did grow up to be an asker of questions. I didn't find any answers, but gosh, asking questions is interesting.
Brilliant. Thank you. Well, mystery and uncertainty is, of course, one of the themes of this festival, and it's emerged in a place that we might not have expected. Facts, truth. We've really had a treat, I think, and thank you so much, Robin, for travelling here and treating us to a really fascinating, wide-ranging, capacious talk. Thank you.
Thank you for the invitation.